Have you ever thought of starting your own judo club? Well, if you are based in New South Wales and starting a judo club is something which has crossed your mind, then listen closely. Judo New South Wales are offering free workshops for all you soon-to-be coaches so that you can get started straight away. And no, I'm not trying to sell you anything. I'm actually trying to connect you with financing, free mentoring, and free marketing guidance resources. So, if you've been feeling the itch to inspire a new generation of judoka, click on the link in the description below and you could be running your own dojo by this time next year.
Hello, hello, and welcome to the Judo Edit podcast. This is your host, Melissa Budiato, and my friends, you will be so glad that you've tuned in today because you are in for an absolute treat. Before we dive into our interview, I'd like to firstly introduce my special co-host for this episode, Mr. Mark Brewer from Fighters Performance Podcast. How's it going, Mark?
Yeah, good. Good to be here. And I know we've got some great stuff in store for everyone.
Exactly. And we are super excited because, friends, right now it is 11 p.m. in Sydney and Mark and I are sitting in a recording studio. That is because the guest we will be interviewing today has been to the Olympic Games 3 times. He has brought home an Olympic silver medal from one of those games. He has 76 wins by Ippon on the international circuit, holds a 5th dan in judo and a black belt in BJJ. He hails from the United States of America. With a fighting weight of 81 kilograms, it is the judo silencer himself, Mr. Travis Stevens. How are you today, Travis?
I'm doing very well, thank you.
Thank you so much for coming on. I'd like to start with some background questions to help our audience understand who you are, like who is the man behind all the strapping tape and bandages? So first thing, you're drinking, I'm assuming, coffee there, is that right?
100% coffee. I had a Diet Coke already and I threw it away.
Saturday morning? Of course you are.
I start every morning with a Diet Coke.
Right, right. But, you know, when you are drinking coffee, what's your favorite coffee order?
You know, I'm super simple. So, like, I don't do fancy coffee. I even refuse to say the word venti at Starbucks. It's whatever's laying around, really.
Macchiato.
I wouldn't even know what's in that.
Double ristretto.
And I don't do iced.
Only hot coffee. Got it. Yeah. Only hot coffee for Travis, guys. Which area of the United States were you born in?
Tacoma, Washington. So West Coast.
West Coast. And
me and Marty Malloy were born just a few hours from each other.
Oh, for right. Real?
Yeah. Huh. We grew up together.
Wow. Who got into judo first?
Not sure. But we used to do the local competition scene with each other when we were like 6. All the way up until we were like 12. And then all through like high school and college.
Yeah, no way.
Yeah, we're like lifelong friends.
You must have had some great influences on that side of America to have 2 of the best of all time, you know, come out of that area.
The West Coast has a huge Asian influx. There used to be a lot of really old Japanese coaches. Mine was one of them, where he used to coach at one of the top high schools in Japan. So when they all moved over to the States, they kind of like set up shop. So you can go to clubs right now that are massive. And there used to be a really, really strong talent pool on the West Coast for judo in America.
Yeah.
Hmm. What sort of club did you start in?
It was, you know, I accidentally signed up for judo at a local youth center where the guy I was coaching out of. I signed up for the wrong sport, got stuck with judo for the season and fell in love with it.
I love that story. Yeah, no, that's actually one of our questions down the line. But like now that you bring it up, what about it got you hooked?
There are very few sports. I was always like an angry kid, an aggressive kid. I grew up in kind of an inner city.
Yeah.
So people always got into fights. People were always selling drugs. Gangs were prevalent through the area. You know, I almost got shipped off to military school as a kid because my parents had trouble controlling me. And judo was like one of those, it's one of the few sports where like you could actually grab another human and beat them. Wrestling is super popular where I grew up too, but you don't grab them. You could hold them, but you can't physically grab someone, right? And jiu-jitsu doesn't have that same kind of physicality either. I'm not sure if there's another sport in the world that does. It's as physical as judo, as far as like being able to grab, push, pull, sweep, throw, hit as judo.
Yeah.
And that's what really brought me to the sport. It kept me in it.
Yeah,
so this
sure.
is what kept you going and kept you in judo.
It was the fun of it. It was the love of it. Like there was no like, oh, you're too strong, you're too this, like, fix it. Go get stronger, go get faster. And then there was always somebody to challenge yourself to, right? Like, there's, if somebody was bigger than you, there was a challenge. If somebody was smaller but more technical, it was a challenge. It was never just this, like, if I'm playing basketball with my friends and they're all 6'5", like, I can't play. I don't get to play the sport anymore. Judo was definitely a good playing field.
And can you remember what was the first technique that you mastered?
Actually, nobody's ever asked me that before.
This is original content, not before it on the internet.
Two-handed Seinagi.
Right.
Was the first. Standing, no dropping.
That is a really technical throw to learn first up.
And that actually carried me all the way through my junior career.
You still do Seinagi, yeah.
not two-handed, though, standing. Mm. I lost the ability when I broke my clavicle.
Look, I've heard you before in a different interview say that even if you didn't end up in judo, even if you had ticked the box for football, that you believe you would still have excelled in it regardless of the sport or the field. So what instilled that belief in you?
I really, really hate being bad at things. Like, really bad. Like, I really don't like it. If somebody beats me at anything, like, I will, on my own time, I will get good at it just to make sure that if it ever comes up again, I'm not bad at it. And then things I know I'm not good at, I'll never do and I'll avoid like the plague. And that's just who I am as a person. Like, I took on digital marketing after my career, and the graphic guy that we used to work with as a company was really frustrating. And I was like, you know what? I can do a better job than you. And now I do all the graphic work for the company. Same thing with basketball, tennis, bowling. I used to have a 225 average for bowling. I could play pool. I can competitively swim.
Wow. What sport can't you do? What are the ones that you stay away from?
I'm not so sure. I can competitively shoot. I know how to ride a horse. I can play basketball, play soccer. I used to play with the Abensburg guys when I used to be in Germany. We used to use it as a cutting weight tool. Throw football, throw baseball. I hate baseball, yeah, though, and cricket. I hate it. The idea that you stand there and let somebody throw a ball at you as hard as they can just seems crazy.
Fair enough.
Completely crazy.
You were obviously like doing judo as a kid on the junior circuit with Marty Malloy. At what age did you set yourself the goal of going to the Olympics, winning a medal at the Olympics?
So from the ages of 11 to about 15, 16, I didn't play any sports. Zero. We were playing a game when I was 11, getting ready for junior nationals. And we put up a big circle, and it was like a group sumo, right? You had to push people out of the circle. And a kid went to shoot a double leg on me. And a kid pushed him from behind, and he speared my kneecap with his shoulder. And my kneecap cracked and went to the side, and it severed all my tendons, my knee. I went through most of middle school on crutches. And then I, freshman year of high school.
Gosh.
And a few pounds?
Yeah. I started high school, believe it or not, playing no sports through middle school. I was 5'8", so I was 3 inches or so shorter than I am now. 223 was my freshman year weight.
Yeah.
My sophomore year weight was 155. Oof. When I could start playing sports again. That sophomore year, end of junior year, start of sophomore year is when I started judo again. And once I started, that's when I made it a point. Like, I was going to do it professionally.
So you're going to have to interpret that a little bit for us in Australia. How old were you when you started judo again? We're not quite sure what freshman is.
So you basically first year of high school.
Okay.
So 15.
15, okay.
And sophomore 16.
Right.
So it was between my 15, 16 that I started judo again.
How long did it take for you after you started judo again at 16 to begin medaling at nationals, to begin medaling at international competitions?
That took a really long time. I graduated high school in 2004, and I won Pan Am Games in 2007. So when I came back to judo, I was 16. And so it took me 5 years,
yeah,
from stepping onto the mat, an overweight kid, to beating Olympic medalist and winning Pan Am Games.
You know, you say that it took a long time, but it doesn't sound like a long time to me from like where you started.
There were so many ups and downs, because when you've done judo your entire life without really taking a solid like years of a break, and people who listen to this who like did judo as a kid and then they try to get back into it when they're adult, they'll understand what I'm saying. Your body doesn't have the physicalness. It can't. Judo is so physical, people don't realize it, that if your body's not conditioned for it, you'll get injured if you jump into it at a high level. So when I came back in high school and I was like, I'm doing this, guys. I knew all my old coaches. And I was like, guys, this is what I want to do. Let's make it happen. And we started training again and properly training. I just got injured left and right. The first 3 weeks, I broke three ribs. A guy hit me right in the side of my ribs doing Ewaza with his knee. And I was done for 2 months. Couldn't play any sports. You know, I dislocated my shoulder. I broke my back twice, 5 herniated discs in my neck. I've torn my hamstring 3 times, 2 on one leg, 1 on another. Like, I went through so much just trying to push through and get back together. Because every time I went to practice, I saw all my old friends and where they were. And they were so much farther ahead that from the start of my career, I was always chasing. It was never an even playing field. And I think it's one of the reasons why I was able to make it in America, because I started the sport feeling like I was playing catch up. So when I was catching my teammates, fine. And then once I passed them, I was catching all the people nationally. And then I was catching everybody internationally. And then I was trying to catch the Japanese and the Russian and the Georgians. I was always chasing people to get better.
Yeah. Yeah, sure. And so you were chasing people until, I guess, you sort of established your own position as an Olympian, because in 2008 you went to your first Olympics. Is that right?
Even then, it wasn't real. Like it was such like a false sense of security. I remember coming back from that game and I was training at Jason Morris's club, and I was so angry after that game. I was so angry because when I moved from home and I moved to Jason's club, he was the Olympic coach. He was going. He was already decided 2 years ahead of time. He's the guy. He's making the team. He's making the plan. We're going to the games. And we had a trials at the time in 2008. And so the top 8 people in the weight class over the span of a year got to fight in this event. And when I won the event, when the people won, judo in America died. It was over. Because most people, most judo players, they chase the Olympic dream. They don't chase the Olympic medal. They chase the dream. And when that dream was over on that day, they were done. Judo was over. Judo didn't come back again into the country until, you know, 2 years later. Because what were they competing for? I can come back. In the States, that's how the flow worked. Everybody quit after the games. And then when the Olympics used to come back around a year, year and a half, 2 years before, people would come out of retirement and start getting points again to go back to the trials to get another Olympic berth, right? And that was the flow in the state. So when I made my first team, the entire country quit. Even teammates, like, they were done. They all went to college. It was the summer. They went to college. They went and got jobs. They stopped showing up to practice. It was me and one other guy that was on the team, and that was it.
Right, yeah.
That's how we figured it out. And I remember being so angry because the staff and the coaches, they didn't make anybody. They didn't have a plan. They didn't foresee that, like, oh, all your training partners are just going to walk away and we can't make them stay because there's no contracts in place.
How has this changed?
It's actually gotten...
In the last two Olympics? Like,
the last two, we traveled as a group collectively. And we worked in a very small group inside the organization. So it was us and a few other people. And then we moved as a unit all around the place. And we just did it that way. We didn't require any resources externally to get better. Like, we instead of like planning on like running camps with the United States, we were like, oh, let's just fly these two people in from over here for you, one person for you over here, and then we'll collectively get better.
Yeah.
Like, we had actually put thought into what types of people you needed to train with. Like, when I got ready for 2016, Nagase is who we thought I would fight on the final because of where the draw landed. So I flew in a world medalist. I flew in the guy that won the universities from Scuba. I flew in Daiki Nishiyama's younger brother, who was 73 fighting 81 at the time. He flew in. So I had three former All Japan or Japanese national team members, one who had won the universities, one I had fought the Grand Slam in Japan, one who was actually currently on the staff that didn't qualify for their training camp for the Olympics. And I was like, hey, you're coming here. Flew in a European, flew in this person, and we did it ourselves with the types of people we felt we needed to train with in order to perform.
Wow.
There was just more thought into, okay, guys, we're back to practice day one.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. I love that initiative that you knew what was needed and you were willing to do what it took together, even if it meant moving people around the world. I guess just looking back at your first Olympics in 2008, despite the fact that you were frustrated with the system, when you walked into Beijing, what did you expect of yourself?
You know, you always expect to win, but there's a difference when you like believe you can. And then there's a difference when you expect yourself to. Like you go through like this weird transition, and I went through it, even through my Olympics. Like I really didn't stand a shot at winning the Olympics. If I was going to win the Olympics, I was going to be the world's biggest fluke in 2008, right? Like I had had big wins against like that guy over there or this guy over here, but I had never until 2008 on the international scene won an international medal. As far as like the IJF is concerned, like I never won Paris. I never won Tokyo. I never medaled at like any real event. I might've had a good win over somebody who had, or like put together a few wins, but I had never strung it together. So the idea that like I was going to string it together at the Olympic Games when all the cards are on the table is like, hey, I hope all of you guys really suck today and I'm really good. That's kind of like the mentality that you went into the Olympics with. And I feel like that's the mentality of like 80% of all judo players when it comes to the Olympic Games. They think they're going to win. They think they're doing everything right, when in reality, they haven't made a change. And they approach the Olympic Games the same way they approach the national championships or Paris or Germany, and it's not the same. So in 2008, I didn't actually do anything different. It was a hard, looking back, I did it just so incorrectly. It's so upsetting because I didn't have anybody there to like lead me and guide me. I remember after the Olympic trials, I went out and like celebrated with my family and my teammates. And then I went home and we did all the newspaper articles. The Olympic Games was 2 months away, by the way. Like we fought it just before. So instead of training, like when you anticipate winning, you don't get the gratification of winning because you've expected, like you're supposed to win, right? Well, if your lifelong dream is to go to the Olympics, why are you celebrating the Olympic trials? Did you not think you were going to win? You should have been planning mentally and psychologically in your head, like, but how could I ever lose? That way, like nobody celebrates if you're an Olympic medalist. Nobody celebrates winning the national championships because it's expected of you and you expect it of yourself. And it's that level of expectation that you need to have if you really want to perform at the Olympic Games. And that thought had never even crossed my mind. Like all the self-help talk, all the mental training in 2008 just never existed. I was just a tough young kid and I could scrap it out. And I barely lost all my matches. I've never fought in Olympic Games and didn't lose to an Olympic medalist. Like everybody that beat me, they medaled at that Olympic Games.
Yeah, yeah.
And barely, as crazy as it is.
You fought Ola Bischoff, or you lost against Ola Bischoff in 2008 as well as 2012, yeah?
Yeah.
Because he won 2008.
Yeah, I kicked him right in the nuts. Purposely too. I'll admit it, purposely. No, just in 2008. It was purposely in 2008. He was winning and I couldn't catch him. He was just so fast and he was so strong. I was like, I got to slow this guy down. So I dropped on my back and I kicked him in the nuts to see if he would slow down. It was the Olympic Games. We had to pull out all the stops. I wanted to win.
Didn't calm down, though.
It didn't. But I didn't have any other answers. There's a great picture of it. Somebody, if you Google my name and like scroll a little bit, you'll find it. I'm like holding both collars on my back with my foot right in his nuts. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. I can't believe that. Okay. And now, like, we can't, I guess, talk about Ole Bischoff and the Olympics without talking about that 2012 semi-final that you fought with him. You know, it was, I was actually just discussing it with Mark just then. It looked like visual poetry because, you know, you're getting more bandaged up as the game went and, you know, you're scrapping it out, you're throwing everything at him and he's sort of still like doesn't have a hair out of place, looking pretty good throughout the whole thing. And it was like,
how he does it. Him and Elmont, man, I don't know how they do it.
I think it must be a German thing.
Yeah, like, it's, I don't know. Elmont was the same way. He always had his hair, like it was perfect. I don't care what you, like I tried to shuffle it a couple of times and like nothing.
Doesn't work for me.
Yeah. So, okay. In that 2012 match, you know, it was a classic, but I'd like to hear it from your point of view. How do you remember that match? What went down?
In the first like 10 or 15 seconds, whatever it was, he threw a close-fisted grip and it hit me right in the eye and split it. And that kind of set the tempo for the match. And from then on out, it was less of a judo match and more of like, I'm going to break your will more than anything. And it was so physical where we were both just trying to get the other person to quit. Like at some point, like I think when he threw that first right hand and it caught me, it just set that tone of like, okay, somebody's going to give up. And nobody ever did. And we actually both, I think, forgot to actually fight the actual match, technically speaking. Like, we were both so stupidly stubborn that we were like, I'm not going to stop. Well, I'm not going to stop either. And we just kept punching each other and kicking each other. And like, yeah, we're trying to throw each other, but when you watch the match, I've only watched it one time, but there was never like a change. Like normally when you watch a judo match, somebody will try to throw somebody forward a few times and they'll try to throw somebody backwards. That there was none of that. We both just kept like bouncing off each other. It was like a Dragon Ball Z episode. Boom, boom, boom. And then eventually time just ran out. And normally what you would see in a judo match is somebody would have like been coming off a training camp or somebody would have been, you know, like I got to fight next week and they would have backed off and then gotten thrown or gotten a shido or mentally kind of like stepped aside and lost. And then we would have went on to the next round, but it was the Olympic Games. So neither of us were really going to give that inch. And he just had the closest, I guess, in the referee's eyes, the closest thing to a score.
Yeah.
I feel like because of that particular match, judo was rewritten for the next squad.
Yeah.
Because of it.
And look, I can see why that would be the case because the level of intensity, and I think you're right, only the Olympic Games can bring it out. Yeah. That was incredible.
I feel like that match was talked about more than the actual final.
I think that match has been talked about more than all of judo combined. Like, I don't think you could find another match. Even when Teddy Riner lost, like, it kind of like, it blurped the radar and then went away. But that match just tends to like come up no matter where you go.
And haunt you.
Yeah, it haunt me forever.
And so before we move on from this match that's still haunting you, you know, it's been 8 years now. You've got a silver medal. When you look back on it, is that still a painful memory?
You know, what's really a painful memory is my entire career was such a failure as like a judo player. Because you can't, like, people don't understand, like, judo players listening to this need to understand that once a tournament happens, it's over. Like, your actions have now been written in time and will never be unwritten. And And when you look back on it, like, yes, I have an Olympic medal, but I should have two. I was better than Bischoff that day. I don't care what anybody says. He might have won the match, but had I not been so stubborn or so childish or whatever, I was a better judo player that day. And I was better than most people that day. And I wouldn't have quit in the Olympic final like he did. He won his, he bagged the Olympic final. I was so upset that he did that. He didn't even fight. When you watch him fight me, he's given it everything. You watch him fight the Korean and he's like, hey, I'm a two-time Olympic finalist. And then he just kind of got thrown over here, got thrown over there, like, and that was, and the match ended.
Was the same, he fought the same guy in both 2008 and 2012.
And I still think there were referees that were watching my match that wanted to see that happen. And people don't realize that the Korean had already won on the other mat next to me. So now if Bischoff wins this one, they get a repeat. They get a story to sell, like another Olympic final matchup. But that's beside the point. When you look at my career, it's actually, it's pretty lackluster. I've only won Pan Ams twice, won Pan Am Games twice. So that's four technically. Zero world medals. I've never even made it to the quarterfinals. Think about that. The most matches I've ever won at a world championships is three. And the year I won three, there was 104 people in the bracket. And you had to win four to make the quarters.
Hmm.
I usually at the world championships went one and done. Hmm. But on the flip side of that, I hold a medal from every major event except for Tokyo, where I have like three or two fifth place finishes. I hate that event. I hate it. And the crazy part is I don't usually lose to the Japanese.
Yeah.
So I was a very consistent person. But at the end of the day, like when you, the stats are the stats. Like there was one year where every time I stepped on a mat, I fought for a medal. And I fought 12 or 14 times. And only at two of the events did I not medal. But at the end of the day, like when you look at the tournaments that matter, like the results aren't there. And a lot of that is due to lack of resources, lack of leadership, stupidity on the athlete's part. A lot of shortcomings that wouldn't have happened had I been a part of like the French judo system, or I'd been a part of the Georgian judo system, or part of the Japanese judo system, where they take better care of their athlete.
Looking back, what have you changed to have better results or seen better results?
I would have started bringing things more internally. There's a big problem with the judo community as a whole, where like everybody feels, except for the developed countries, right? Everybody feels like, hey, if you go to Japan, you're going to get good at judo. That's not true. It's 100% not true. I just need to go to Europe. I just need to go to this. And a lot of athletes, I would say 95% of them, they just want to go to events to be able to say they went there, and they don't feel ashamed based on their performance. They feel honored and privileged to go. And it's hard to train in an environment where you're trying to perform when everybody around you is just happy for what you're doing. You know, everybody's just super happy for it. And it's like, I can't perform under those circumstances. Right. If everybody's so excited that you took a bronze medal instead of feeling like, hey, you let us down, like we didn't want a bronze, we wanted a gold, and they just expected more of you. Like we're high level athletes, we'll rise to the occasion. It's what we're bred to do. But we didn't necessarily have the surroundings in order to raise that level in order to perform. That's why a lot of times the countries that do the best are the ones that are, you know, unified, where like everybody is like-minded, everybody's trying to do the same thing. Everybody wants everybody to win because they're competing as a unit. And then they bring each other up. Even if one person falls, they're there to help the other group out. We always just did it so alone. I would change that. I would make it more, and we did a really good job of that from 2011 to 2016. We had a core group of five or six people, and we traveled, and then when the team was with us, there was always two teams. There was just two separate teams.
Yeah. So I guess that actually dovetails right into my next question, because I was going to ask what changed between 2012 and 2016, but it almost sounds like it was more of the environment as opposed to yourself. Is that right?
Yeah. You know, in the States, when you try to do judo, it's not professional. Right now in the United States, the highest level judo player from the organization makes $24,000 a year, which doesn't even pay the rent in most places, much less like food, training costs, travel costs, all of that. And I remember when I first started back in 2000, after 2008, 2009, I was traveling all over the world. I had sponsors paying for my travel. I was trying to pay for my own living expenses and food. And the way the system worked in the US was if you had, let's say, an A-level rank with 20 points, you make $1,500 a month. But if you had an A-level with 30 points, you made $2,000 a month. And they said, hey, there's $80,000 in this pool of money. The top five athletes get a check. And then when the money's gone, the money's gone. So if somebody was pulling $2,000 out of it every month and the next person was pulling $2,000 and you had 10 or 12 people pulling money out of this pot, it could dwindle away in a year. It could dwindle away in 3 months. It just really depended on like where those levels were. So everybody in the United States was competing all of the time. And they were selecting tournaments that you could go to in order to get points. And I was one of them because I needed that $2,500 coming in every month so that I could pay my gas, my food, my rent. So I had people paying for the trips. And what was happening, and the reason why my world performances are so bad, was I was competing all through the summer to make sure that my points were lasting. I wasn't training to win the world championships. I was competing to make sure I had enough money coming in, right? The mentality of the athlete is different.
Right.
If I'm looking at the calendar going, man, my body really hurts right now, but I realize I'm going to drop on that monthly radar to lose money. Like, I got to go to South America to go win this event and make a final. And that summer, I actually ended up doing that a month before the Worlds. I flew all the way down to, I think it was Argentina. Maybe it was Dominican Republic. I can't remember. And I fought Victor Penalver in the final. And I was so tired. I was so beat up because I think I was on my competition 10 of the year by June internationally. And I threw a hard overhand in the final and he put his hand up and it hit my wrist. But I threw my hand was like, it was limp. So when he hit it, it actually cracked my wrist and fractured it in the final. And I was on the bus with the team manager and he's like, how's your wrist? And I was so angry. I was like, I think I broke it. And he's like, really? And I go, yeah. And he goes, so what are we going to do about the Worlds? And I was like, who cares? Like, and we had this big, long discussion about, you know, what the problem was in USA Judo, how we were going to change it, what we're going to do. And I was like, you know what? You guys want me to perform? Put me on salary so that I can at least pay my bills. If I'm not competing to pay my bills and we can start, you know, finding time to actually train and get better at the sport, we could perform. And they actually took that to the USOC and said, hey, look, these guys are winning, but they're competing too much. We could build a platform from what they've done and we could boost them and we could get them to the Olympic medal. And they sold the United States Olympic Committee on funding this salary program. And every year we got better and we got better and our salaries went up and up and up to where we went from making $30,000 a year to making almost $90,000 a year by 2016. Just from a salary, not including like medal performances, sponsorships, because what you did was you changed the mentality of the athlete to we're competing to win. And then sometimes we competed for learning sakes. Like we would go to certain tournaments just to practice certain techniques and certain moves. It had nothing to do with winning. We're just here for practice. I want you to practice now that we've developed this technique and this movement. Here's a place where we think athletes are going to be moving like this. Let's go there and see if you could perform it. And then we're like, hey, but then next month we're going to go over here and I want you to win this event. And we just started like systematically putting things in place. But by the time I hit 2016, I was 30 years old and I didn't get groomed in that system, right? I had suffered so many injuries just from the time I started to the time I realized there was a better way, that I really lacked the actual results. And it's something that judo needs to change worldwide.
Yeah.
And a lot of countries really, especially ours, struggle with it because the IJF says, hey, it's on you to figure this out. And then that means the guy sitting in the chair making the decision has to feel bad telling the kid he can't go because he's not good enough.
Yeah.
Like by law, we're not allowed to do that in the States.
Yeah. But so it's crazy that even though you didn't come out of that system, you still, I guess, managed to get yourself to that level where you could win a medal in 2016. So what did it feel like to win that silver medal in Rio? What was it like to realize that dream?
Like a giant weight of pressure had been lifted off my chest because I felt so cheated for years from 2012. All these like little things were like building up into like, I really honestly felt like the world was so against me into 2016 that when I had knee surgery in 2015, after everything that had happened medically in 2015, because I didn't really compete the year of 2015. Jimmy and I almost quit. I was like, guys, like, what are the chances of me actually making the Olympic final and winning? What's the point? And he actually convinced me to like get through it, get back on training. And when I finally just threw my hands up in the air and was like, I'm just going to compete the way I want to compete. And I want to compete to the best of my ability. And if it's not good enough, then so be it. I didn't even care if I medaled or not. I wanted to be able to walk out onto the Olympic platform and show the world like what kind of judo I'm really capable of. And if it's not good enough, then okay, it's not good enough. It was no longer about the medal in 2016. I just wanted to perform. And I just wanted to show everybody the type of competitor that I was. Not the angry, like, you know, American that was bucking the system, right? Not that guy. I wanted just to show everybody like, hey, this is the judo I'm capable of, and I'm going to let the cards fall where they may. And it was when I took all that pressure off of having to prove everybody wrong and, you know, prove that I'm good enough. Like, I didn't care anymore. I was sitting in a hospital bed doing kind of what you did, looking over my career as a whole and saying, look, like, I may not have world championship medals. I may not have these medals, but I have 2 European gold medals from Oppensburg. I fight on one of the best Bundesliga teams that have ever existed on the planet. I've won Pan Am games twice where I'm actually undefeated at. I've won Pan Am championships twice. I've only ever lost at the Olympic Games 2 Olympic medalists. I've competed for 1 Olympic medal. I'm going into my 3rd. I go, you know what? If I had to hang my hat on my career, I'm 100% okay with what I've accomplished. Once I did that, people can't take those away from you. Right. So once I looked at my career and I was satisfied, I was competing just for the joy of competing in 2016. And when I took off all that pressure, wins just started coming because I didn't care if I won or lost. I was just doing it to do it. And judo got really easy and really fun.
That's part 1 of Travis' story. To be the first to hear when part 2 drops, subscribe to The Judo Edit wherever you are listening and follow The Judo Edit on Instagram. Friends, it brings me a lot of joy to create these episodes, and if you also enjoy listening to them, do me a small favor and share it with a friend. The more people that listen, the more quality guests I can interview and bring to your ears. You could send it to a training partner or just repost it on Facebook or Instagram. Thanks to Mark Brewer for co-hosting this episode. You can subscribe to Fighters Performance Podcast and hear more about Mark there. Once again, stay tuned for part 2 of Travis Stevens' story in the next few weeks. Until then, this is Melissa Budiato signing off.